From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report for the 30th day of March 2017. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Dan Zwicker. He's at Zwicker Consulting out of Waco, Texas. A bit later in the program, we'll be joined by Emerson Nafziger. He has a review of the University of Illinois planting date studies for corn and soybeans. And maybe not so surprisingly, but in some respects it is, the planting dates have widened out on the back end and the front end for both corn and soybeans. We'll hear from him about those issues. And then as we wrap up our time together, we'll talk about the weather forecast with Mike Tenorum. He's at T-Storm in Chicago. And it all happens on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media on this Thursday afternoon. Time to turn our attention now to what happened in the marketplace. Dan Zwicker is with us. He's at Zwicker Consulting out of Waco, Texas. Dan, we missed you last week, but that's because I was traveling. This week, I thought we might have a better shot at talking about something more positive, but that doesn't seem to be the case today.
No, the month of March usually ends up being what the March report, the grain stocks and the acreage report has to say at the end of the month. So here we are with less than 24 hours. We'll see what farmers' planting intentions report will show us and what kind of, you know, March 1st grain stocks we have on hand. And that's going to lay the marker. Basically for what happens over the next 3 months, barring any kind of weather severity. As a rule, markets usually price in whatever the trade average of estimates are. But when you get into these quarterly reports, they very often have a surprise in them. Which way, nobody really knows. But just glancing, I suppose, at the acreage estimates and looking at the acreage averages, at least from the people that I have talked to, I would say maybe the average estimate on soybean plantings might be low and the corn plantings number may be high. To what extent, we don't know. Often USDA doesn't necessarily use up all the acres that's maybe available for planting in the March report. So more often than not, I've always remember the March reports as the trade always, where did all the acres go? And then by the time June comes around, then the June numbers are usually higher than the March numbers, and everybody hollers, well, where did all the acres come from? And I wouldn't be a bit surprised maybe that the acreage estimates may come in lower than what the trader thinking and would be a little price supportive. Unfortunately, the grain stocks are going to reflect some fairly hefty numbers. Probably what the trade will be watching for the most is probably corn stocks and how many of those are on farm versus off farm, because there's a general belief that farmers still own quite a few old crop corn inventories to be parceled out here between now and probably the growing season until they feel comfortable with new crop prospects. But like I said, you never know when you go into a quarterly stocks report. I'm always ready for a surprise, so there'll probably be something on that order. And I guess since the market has kind of been weak for the month of March, maybe they could be all a little bit generally supportive and then maybe give this market a breather and we could have some kind of recovery rally here during the month of April.
Now, I know things could change tomorrow, but let's say they don't at this point, at least in terms of where prices are, generally speaking. Where does your research tell you technically things are headed?
Well, you have to, I mean, the technicals have been down here for a few weeks, and they remain down. Now, they are, some of the technicals that I look at are in position to be a supportive influence as we go forward from here. How much of a supportive influence it's only time will tell, but we're in some oversold technical conditions, both on a daily basis and a weekly basis. Timing studies would say that we are ripe for some kind of bounce in here. So, you know, I would probably lean that there is at least a breather in this market coming or some kind of recovery rally. But that's all going to depend, too, probably on how the spring weather pattern plays out. Listening to your forecast, doesn't look like anybody's planting any corn yet, or at least not in the northern half of the Corn Belt. Now there's probably some going on in the southern half. We got corn up down here in the valley, but this corn, we really don't count. But we've been sitting at 90 degrees here for the past several days. We're cooler today at 85, but tomorrow we're supposed to go back to 90 and stay that way for a few days. So it's plenty warm here in South Texas. But I think, you know, we'll have to just see how the growing season plays out, planting season. I'm still inclined to watch sunspot activity, and sunspot activity would suggest cooler, drier type pattern as we go through the growing season, but we'll have to see how that plays out. I would be inclined to think that most of the bearishness that the trade has talked about over the past month or so is kind of baked in the cake, barring a major surprise tomorrow. And like I said, stocks reports will throw you one every once in a while, and maybe we're going to get one tomorrow.
You think it's the feed and residual usage number? It usually is. That's the problem.
Well, that always shows up. And of course, the feed and residual number is always, you know, if there's a big change in that, then that kind of indicates that maybe the USDA production number may be wrong, whether it's high or low, and or, you know, consumption isn't as good as what we think. But you know, you can sure look at the export demand. I mean, export demand has been super great. And, you know, I would think domestic consumption would be fairly decent, too. But we did raise a big crop last year. And when you get into those big numbers that we raised last year, it maybe takes USDA a couple quarterly reports to get it zeroed in on. And, of course, this will be the second one that will be halfway through the marketing year. So this will give us a good clue as to what domestic usage is going at. And then it would also indicate whether or not maybe USDA is too high or too low on their production numbers. We'll just have to see how the trade interprets it if there's some big changes there. The supply demand numbers are not going to be tomorrow. They'll be on the March or on the April report, but the trade will anticipate those supply demand changes as we go on into the April report.
Absolutely. Hey, thanks so much. We'll talk with you again next week.
Okay, very well, Todd.
That is Dan Zwicker. He's with Zwicker Consulting out of Waco, Texas. In today's agricultural news, the Senate Agriculture Committee today approved Sonny Perdue's nomination for Ag Secretary by a voice vote. Perdue's nomination now heads to the full Senate for final confirmation. It was not immediately clear when that vote would be held. Perdue, a former two-term GOP governor of Georgia, was supported by every lawmaker present for the vote except for Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York. She's a Democrat who logged her disapproval over Perdue's record on food stamps, and Senator David Perdue, Sonny Perdue's cousin, who abstained. On to other items now. Cargill's CEO took a stand for international trade during a speaking engagement this week. David McLennan told the Financial Times Commodities Summit in Switzerland that the world is at a critical tipping point in the international trade policy arena. He called on industries represented at the event to support the development of sound trade agreements and to be on guard against a growing sentiment toward more restrictive trade measures. And McLennan told the audience, "The success of our companies, our employees, and the wider world depends on us making a strong collective stand for trade." In addition to advocating for comprehensive trade agreements, McLennan argued for public policies that will result in the creation of a new workforce paradigm in which the public and private sectors work together to provide ongoing education and training to workers, including those whose jobs are threatened either by the consequences of trade or by other factors such as greater implementation of robotics and information technology. Sounding something of a different note, the National Farmers Union is asking President Donald Trump to oppose the merger between Dow and DuPont. NFU wants the administration to block the deal because of concerns it would lead to reduced competition and less innovation, as well as less choice and higher prices for farm inputs. NFU President Roger Johnson says if the Dow-DuPont and Bayer-Monsanto mergers were both approved, there would effectively be a duopoly in corn and soybean seed markets. Farmers Union says the merger of Dow and DuPont, the fourth and fifth largest firms, would give the resulting company about 41% of the market for corn seeds and 38% of the market for soybean seeds. The European Union approved the merger after Dow and DuPont agreed to sell off assets, including key research and development activities. The deal is still to be approved by regulators in the United States, Brazil, China, Australia, and Canada. Well, switching topics just a bit, a new nationwide study has found Americans seem to remain confused about new fuel choices at the pump and their appropriate usage. The study was commissioned by the Outdoor Power Equipment Institute and surveyed more than 2,000 adults online. The poll found that more consumers have reported misfueling engines not recommended for ethanol blends higher than 10%, which includes small engines outdoor power equipment, increasing from 3% in 2015 to 5% in the most recent study. Study results show ethanol awareness in fuels remain steady at 84% and that 44% of the outdoor power equipment owners are paying attention to the type of fuels they're using. Ethanol blends greater than 10% in small engines is not authorized by the Environmental Protection Agency. Regardless of the fuel, the Outdoor Power Equipment Institute says it's also important to drain fuel out of small engines if they will be left unused for more than 30 days or to at least add a fuel stabilizer. And finally today, let's come back to Washington, D.C. and the Trump administration as it relates to its goals for NAFTA and the TPP. They're kind of the same, but different. The Trump administration outlines in an 8-page draft letter to Congress how it will renegotiate NAFTA and gives a predictable nod to the persistent U.S. trade deficit with Canada and Mexico. This according to ProTrade's Adam Bershoti and Doug Palmer. But the letter, a copy of which was obtained by Politico, strays little from what Congress has mandated in Trade Promotion Authority legislation and in many respects reflects what the Obama administration sought to achieve in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The administration tries to provide some comfort to farm and business groups that are worried about losing exports they enjoy under the 23-year-old agreement, saying it will seek to maintain and expand current market access between the three countries. The letter does include some policies more aligned with Trump's economic nationalism, such as tightening rules of origin, putting in place a general safeguard mechanism, and eliminating a NAFTA chapter that allows Mexico or Canada to challenge U.S. trade remedy decisions. In other respects, the negotiating principles match what the Obama administration secured in the TPP, enforceable labor and environmental obligations, data free flow requirements, and disciplines on state-owned enterprises. And that's a look at today's agricultural news. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up, we'll hear some planting date recommendations from Emerson Nafziger. The University of Illinois agronomist is surprised by the consistency between corn and soybeans. The U of I has conducted planting date studies for decades, and Emerson Nafziger smiles to himself when he says he's been here for more than a couple of them. It's the last decade, he says, that has really changed things.
And the big surprise we're finding is that the planting date responses for corn and soybean are so similar. What I think has happened with genetic improvement in both crops is they've both become more stress tolerant and resilient, and late planting has not quite as damaging to yield potential as it probably was 20 or 30 years ago.
Here's the other thing. Nafziger says the old rule is that soybean suffers less than corn from late planting. This meant farmers planted corn first, and only when that was completed would soybean be sown. This isn't the situation today, says Nafziger.
The fact is that those two lines of yield declines as you get into May and late May planting for corn and soybeans, as a percentage of their maximum yield for that site, those two lines lie right on top of each other. And it basically says the priority for planting date is now pretty much the same for both corn and soybeans.
The point being, when soil conditions are right, especially late in the planting season, there isn't a reason to prioritize based on crop, corn or soybeans, but rather to just plant the field that's in the best condition first. This lengthens out the viable planting dates at the end of the season. A similar thing has happened at the front of the season, too, says Nafziger.
I think that today, with the what we've found with corn and soybeans, sometime in mid-April to late April is really a best time to plant either corn or soybeans. I would still be inclined to start corn if we're starting in early or before the middle of April, but I'd certainly... if I had two planters, I'd have the second one planting soybeans, you know, pretty soon after that as fields are ready to plant.
If you'd like to read more about the University of Illinois planting date studies for corn and soybeans, please look for Emerson Nafziger's article on the Bulletin website. You can search Google for Bulletin, University of Illinois. I'm Todd Gleason. This is the closing market report for Thursday afternoon. It's the 30th day of March. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason, joined now by Mike Tenura. He's at T-Storm Weather out of Chicago. Mike, thanks for being with us. Glad you're back today.
Thank you. Great to be back.
Let's start with the hard red winter wheat growing regions. Very concerned over many of the winter months that it was very dry there. Have we alleviated that situation?
We certainly have, and that's primarily because of all the rain that's occurred over the last 2 days. We have a way to analyze how dry or wet any crop in the United States is at any moment. And if you take a look at what's happened over the last couple of days in the hard red winter wheat belt, the proportion of wheat that was drier than normal over the last 60 days absolutely crumbled by more than 50 points leading into this rain event just a couple of days ago. About two-thirds of U.S. hard red winter wheat production had been considerably drier than normal over the past 60 days. As we stand here this morning, numbers are nowhere near that high, having dropped all the way down to nearly 10%. So dryness is just not a big issue. And one other thing we would point out is that a lot of people seem to have forgotten just how much rain there was back in the middle of January. There was a major rain event across the central and southern plains around January 15th of this year, and that pretty much wiped out what had been a developing drought. So when you take that huge rain event with this one now about 9 to 10 weeks later, there just are not any dryness issues to talk about in the hard red winter wheat belt. It's hard to make much of an argument anymore that is too dry for hard red winter wheat.
What's your assessment of preseason conditions in the Midwest?
Well, it's a little bit interesting in that rainfall over the last 6 months has been considerably below normal across the southern half of the central U.S., primarily from along Interstate 80 and points onto the south. Now, these areas also were pretty dry back in 2015, but what ended up happening in 2015 is that it started to rain in April, and then it rained again in May, and it kept raining right through June, and that's how we ended up with above-trend corn and soybean yields. Now, whether or not that happens again this year, we don't know for sure. The only thing we do know is that we've had a big system go through over the last 12 to 24 hours. We have more rain on the way through tonight in the eastern Corn Belt, and then we have another rain event coming up early next week and another one late next week. So by the time you put this all together, we'll have seen three significant rainfalls in about an eight-day period across these areas that were unseasonably dry.
Can you turn your attention now to second crop corn in Brazil?
Brazil's second crop corn has been receiving ample rains over the last several weeks. This is in direct contrast to what happened 1 year ago when they had a major drought. It's going to continue raining across much of Brazil over the next couple of weeks, so there's going to be a real hard argument to make for problems for that second crop corn in Brazil. So right now, it's looking pretty good and maybe even very good. Argentina's a little bit too wet in a few different areas, but this wet pattern is starting to break down a little bit. At least it will once we get into next week. So even there, hard to argue about dryness issues. Pretty much the entire world is wet and is going to stay that way for a little while.
Hey, thanks, Mike. Mike Tenores with T-Storm Weather in Chicago, Illinois. I'm Yovi Extension's Todd Gleason.